We're now going to take this discussion of Margaret Seltzer in the news of the week to our reporters' roundtable. Joining me now, Kevin Merida. He's the associate editor of the Washington Post and editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Also with us, Newsday columnist Cheryl McCarthy and Ernie Suggs. He's an urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, folks.
How are you?
Hey, Farai.
I'm doing great. Ernie, let me start with you. You heard us talking about Love and Consequences, this fake memoir.
Yes.
The publisher said that Seltzer provided evidence. And, you know, in this business, as a journalist, a lot of times we rely on books and previous material, books, documentaries,
sure.
TV
yeah.
shows. We all kind of bite off of each other. And so what responsibility do you have if you want to use a book or other research that other people have done to make sure that they actually represented what they were saying?
Well, I mean, you want to go to the credibility of the book and go to the credibility of the person. I doubt very many reporters would have used Margaret's book recently to do any kind of research. Anytime we use or I use a book in a story that I'm writing, it's from a credible writer, it's from a credible source. Everything that we do, everything that Kevin will tell you that we try to do, we try to get from credible sources.
But what do you mean by credible? What makes something or someone credible to you?
Well, I mean, you know the person. The person has a track record. I mean, I don't know this person. No one knows this Margaret Jones, or no one knew who she was. So someone that has a track record, someone that you may have talked to, you know, sometimes you just don't pick up a book and quote it. You know, if I want to write something about Kevin's book on Clarence Thomas, I'll call Kevin and perhaps talk to him about that. But it's a matter of building a trust with that source. I think the important thing for all journalists to know and understand is the credibility of their sources. And if you don't have any kind of relationship with that book or that person, it's probably not a good idea to use it.
Kevin, have you ever been taken advantage of by a source, or has someone even tried it?
Well, I think that sources they're always, oftentimes, people have some angle of their own that they're pushing. And I recall doing a column once with about the issue of trafficking, human trafficking. And this was a very high-level official at the State Department. And it was a worthwhile column to do. And she gave me some examples that then it turns out that she was using a pseudonym. And I was furious about it. I mean, I said that, you know, we can't use pseudonyms. I mean, you have to tell me that. I mean, I think that you're giving me an actual example. And I certainly didn't use it. But
mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't know, as Ernie says, you're taking the credibility of people that you have trusted or relied on, and you're using your own instincts to vet them and often. And, you know, it's a question of judgment a lot.
Cheryl, how do you make decisions about using acquired material or even just to influence you as you're looking around for story ideas? I mean, there are people who, you know, some people have compared this to any number, you know, Jason Blair scandal, other news scandals. And I do think that there's a difference between, you know, these news scandals and these literary scandals, but it's just a different venue. So how do you make sure that you're not getting the short end of the stick?
Well, you know, I probably have been had in the past and just didn't know about it. But, you know, you call up, you know, as Kevin said, as I think it was Ernie who said, you know, people that you trust. Sometimes it's PR people. Sometimes it's academic people. Sometimes it's people in politics. And, you know, ask them to recommend, you know, people who can speak to you with some intelligence on an issue. And that's usually the way I go. You know, if you're picking up a book like this one, you are assuming, you're in a tricky position, you're assuming that it's already been vetted by the editor and by the people at Random House, and that you can sort of, you know, assume that it's genuine. And often if you are writing a column quickly, you know, it's kind of hard to check around, you know, into her background and whether she went to the college she claims she did and whether she's from the family she's from. So that could make it tricky. And I think it could be easy to get deceived by a book.
So you think basically that, you know, there is a certain level of trust that journalists have about publishers, whether or not that trust is always warranted?
I do. And, you know, my reaction to this story was originally, boy, I wish writers would stop, you know, writing these scam memos. I mean, haven't they learned enough from the people who've been caught? If you want to write about gangbangers in the ghetto, I mean, you can write a credible nonfiction book. You just have to do a lot more work. And also, you know, I just sort of wonder, you know, where the editor was over 3 years and that she didn't catch on to this person's naivete. And you know what I think was at the bottom of it? Probably a certain typical thinking about the hood, about gangbangers and what it was like. So when she brought this, all these wild, over-the-top stories to the editor, this editor saying, oh, wow, did that really happen? And I think you probably got that from probably both of them, you know, from this person who's writing what she thinks is an authentic story about the hood and from the editor who thinks she's hearing an authentic story.
All right. Well, I have to break into the conversation now because it is a big one, but we have to take a break. Cheryl, Kevin, Ernie, stay with us. We're going to come back with more of our Reporters Roundtable. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back for more of our Reporters Roundtable. I'm with Kevin Merida of The Washington Post, Cheryl McCarthy of Newsday, and Ernie Suggs of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So let's move on to some political news. You've got Florida and Michigan. The delegates are on the chopping block. Some people are urging for the votes from these states to count. They don't count because the Democratic Party said, hey, you can't move up without our permission. And now the heads of the local parties, the state parties, are saying, well, what, are you going to disenfranchise us? So, you know, Kevin, I just wonder if Howard Dean is the unhappiest man in the world right now, because there's a lot of people. It's like, you know, going to a family picnic and going in with a bowl of candy and everybody's tugging at you saying, you know, more for me, more for me. What is he going to do about this?
Well, he's definitely on the hot seat. And, you know, I think that the train is heading toward seating the delegations. I mean, I think that they're going to figure out some way to seat the delegations, whether that's a so-called do-over election, and I think that's going to be a heavily negotiated process, whether or not, take for instance, Michigan has a caucus system. You know, there have been proposals to split the delegates based on the votes that counted. But I think that what he's going to do is assemble some party leaders, some of the elders, and really try to figure out something that seems equitable for all sides. You know, there are going to be people upset no matter what, Farai, because there are going to be some people who said that, you know, we had a process and we had a meeting. I talked to a super delegate the other day and said that if we don't follow our own rules, then they're not worth the price of the paper that they're written up on. So I think there's not going to be anybody happy, but I think the party doesn't want to take the chance of not seating two major states that are really swing states for the Democrats in the fall and take any chances of depressing turnout in the kind of close elections we've seen in the past two presidential contests.
Cheryl, I want to move us on to a different topic. Just this morning, Samantha Power, who was one of Barack Obama's top advisors, she wrote an award-winning book on genocide, resigned after calling rival Hillary Rodham Clinton a, quote, monster. This comment was apparently off the record, and it was told to a reporter at The Scotsman, but the Scottish newspaper printed it anyway. And was this an unethical move by the journalist or a bad mistake by Power or both?
Oh, I think it was a bad mistake by Power. You know, this is an election. It's hard fought. And if you're a journalist and you hear this kind of thing, you know, you can't not report it. But I think it just points up, you know, how you really have to, I hate to quote Ari Fleischer, but you have to watch what you say, you know, in these kinds of things. And it just sort of reverberated in a bad way, you know, back onto Hillary Clinton's campaign.
Ernie, it reminds me a little bit in the broader sense of when Reverend Jackson made the Hymietown remark back in 84, referring to the Jewish population in New York. And it was also off the record, but it was also printed. Is there really ever anything that is really off the record?
Well, it goes to the rules that you set from the jump when you're talking to someone. There are several levels there. It's off the record. There's background. There's, you know, deep background. But if you're just having a conversation with a reporter, I tell people, and every reporter can tell you, when you pick up a phone and call someone, a source, or meet someone face-to-face, they have to assume that it's on the record unless some ground rules have been set. As you know, I'm a member of NABJ, and on our listserv today, that's been the big topic. What's on the record?
NABJ, Black Journalists Association. And I am a proud member.
Of course, all of us.
I just want to point out for people who don't know what NABJ is.
But on our listserv today, that's a big discussion about what is on the record and what is off the record. And I agree with Ms. McCarthy. I think that the person it's a delicate situation. I mean, it's something that she shouldn't have said, but if the reporter feels that it was on the record and it was established early on that it was on the record, then anything you say can be used against you.
What does this mean, you think, Kevin? Right now, people always line up their dream teams of campaign advisors, and if you win, many of them go on to become, you know, everything from cabinet members to staffers. All sides have some impressive advisors. What do you think this means, if anything, for the Obama campaign?
Well, I don't know that it means much in terms of that, whether or not, you know, they lose a key advisor or not. I think that we're in such a close race that everybody's looking for an advantage. I suspect that the Clinton campaign will continue to pounce on this, and the attempt is to always try to have your challenger on the defensive. And if he's on the defensive trying to defend a remark by one of his advisors, then, you know, she's going to try to make it seem like this says something about the candidate and the campaign. And in fact, you know, Barack Obama is many miles away. He can't control everybody. But I think that in this period that we're in, where everything is so close, we're really in kind of a tactical fight right now.
I want to take a quick tour through another very big topic. In the Middle East yesterday, 8 students were shot in a Jewish seminary in Jerusalem. One of the students killed was an American. It happened right after a visit from the U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, in which she urged Israel and the Palestinians to resume peace talks. Now, President Bush put on the table that this was going to be one of his legacy items, that he was going to try to broker peace. There's been huge fighting in Gaza, 120 Palestinians and 4 Israelis killed at the minimum. Where's the state of negotiations? I mean, Cheryl, do you have any sense that this is anything that the administration is really going to focus on, given that things are so desperate right now?
Well, I think they're trying to focus on it. And I think Condoleezza Rice, having blown it with the Iraq War, is looking for some, you know, better legacy, you know, of her stewardship of the State Department. But, you know, I hear things like this, and, you know, I almost don't know what to say about the Israelis and the Palestinians anymore. You know, I remember when I thought that the Irish and the Brits were never going to have peace, and they've gone up to have it for a number of years, and the Palestinians and the Israelis are still at it. And it just seems to be, you know, each side is always waiting for the other side to make the first move, to have the courage to, you know, call off the dogs and say, we're going to give concessions, we're going to pull our people off, we're going to do the right thing. And it seems if you have people who've been warring with each other for decades and decades, nobody, their leaders are not willing to do that, then they're always pointing the finger at the other side, then you just aren't going to get to peace.
Ernie, what do you see coming out of this, specifically from the U.S. policy side?
Well, not much. I mean, there have been 130 people killed, 130 Palestinians killed since February 27th, I believe. And, you know, President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have 10 months. They have 10 months to broker an agreement or broker peace. They have 10 months to get us out of Iraq. The United States government right now has a very small window in which to try to make a significant difference in the Middle East. And I just don't think that this administration at this particular time, considering the escalation that's happened recently, is going to make that much of a difference.
Kevin?
Well, no, I don't see that. I mean, I think that there's so many things on the plate. The economy is really the number one issue that's driving American interests. And I think that that's going to really, really consume this administration and they're going to be trying to figure out how to deal with that in conjunction with their soon-to-be nominee, John McCain.
Well, I want to thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Cheryl McCarthy, a columnist for Newsday. She joined us from our studio in New York. Kevin Merida, associate editor for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from the studios at The Washington Post. And Ernie Suggs, urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.